recording service. There we go. Good evening. Welcome back to the American Prison State. I'm Dan D'Amico. Today's lecture is an extension of last week's lecture, which was predominantly focused upon surveying some empirical evidence regarding the facts and realities of the criminal justice system in America today and over time. Now, in general, what I was trying to explain is that there is a parallel of explanatory burden on the task of any, what we could call broadly, most broadly, criminological theory. Mainly theories which explain and account for the facts and realities of crime and punishment. The parallel is to macroeconomics as a similarly complex social phenomenon. The stylized facts of macroeconomics have to be explained in their mystic qualities, mainly that if we were to have a theory of how capital grows, accumulates, and disseminates throughout society, what we need to be able to do is explain the particular patterns of when capital grows, where it accumulates, and then sort of how cyclical patterns grow and shrink capital bases in various areas. So with regard to the criminal justice system, the similar sort of list of particular facts and characteristics that need to be explained are the uniquely modern phenomenon of what we could call punitive severity. Now, in particular, what we're surveying today is just sociological theories that attempt to explain these facts and realities. We're not talking terribly too much about economics, though. What we'll be doing is criticizing some of the theories with some basic economic concepts and trying to draw parallels or explain where it is in particular that that the theories rephrase or restate insights that are common in economic science. But more generally, what we're going to be surveying today is conceptual frameworks, mental models, if you will. Ways to look at these trends in the facts and empirical conditions of crime and punishment. So we said that punitive severity is a relatively modern phenomenon. It's also a broader phenomenon than mass incarceration in particular. In other words, punitive severity or disproportionately severe criminal punishments are sort of an abstract concept in and of themselves. It's very difficult to compare apples with apples if you're talking about different countries or different times and places, because not only does the magnitude of a punishment change, so let's say like you're getting lashings in 1700 and lashings in 1800, if the same crime is associated with 10% more lashings 100 years later, then you would say, well, punishments have gotten more severe. But then how do you make that objective comparison when you change punishment type and magnitude simultaneously? It becomes a much more difficult concept. So when sociologists argue, well, actually, I mean, there's a consensus amongst sociologists on this point that what we have today is more severe than what we used to have. Secondly, that severity is excessive and arguably inefficient or costly in terms of social, cultural, and financial consequences, and that it's caused for some form of social change, social action. That's an operating presumption from the get-go for most sociologists. It is not necessarily an operating presumption from a lot of the perspectives of more conservative social critics or Many economists are content with arguing that the current system is relatively efficient. Now, I think that there is good and significant reason, in light of the facts that we covered in the last class, to take seriously and consider this sociological perspective that our current system is perhaps excessive. In particular, I think the reason why we have to consider that is because of the sustainability concerns, that it doesn't seem to be practical to continue at this trend, as well as the sort of international comparative points that if our current practices were efficient, then we shouldn't be able to get comparable results from other countries in terms of the rates of crime and the degree of social order that are achieved, yet we do. And we also should be concerned insofar as we're an extreme outlier in the rates that we are. So punitive severity is more abstract than just increased quantities of a given punishment. In broader terms, breaking down punitive severity into like its constituent parts, part one is that more things are deemed criminal. So if you were to imagine sort of like a fixed criminal punishment process, or a fixed criminal justice process and a fixed criminal punishment process, then the quantity and frequency of things that are deemed criminal or prohibited are sort of growing. This is in part an inevitable consequence of a growing advanced division of labor or a more intricately diversified society. In other words, we have an entire realm of criminal law that applies to cyberspace now, in large part because we didn't have cyberspace 50 years ago. So part of that is to be expected, but other parts, there are behaviors that have been around for a very long time, and yet they sort of get added to these lists of criminal prohibitions. The drug war is an obvious example. But also the way in which different activities are treated as criminal or with enforcement by means of the criminal justice system or like law enforcement techniques, they get added on. So for example, the way in which police respond to things like immigration controls, traffic violations, et cetera, is arguably more severe in recent times than in the past. Radley Balko's work, when he was at Reason and now and at Cato, I think, really speaks to this fact. I mean, basically what he's doing is tracking the militarization of police forces in contemporary America today. If you look at sort of like the weaponry and the resource technologies that police officers have at their disposal over time, that seems to be getting far more intensified, and their frequency of use also far more frequent. Secondly, there's more convictions. We covered that last week. The probability of being arrested, the probability of standing trial has relatively stayed the same since, say, the 1970s and 1980s, but the probability of being convicted and sentenced to prison has significantly increased. The length of criminal sentences has increased. Which is to say that there are sort of new legislations like mandatory minimum sentencing laws, three strikes you're out laws. Those are unique to the American experience. And a few other mostly Western advanced developed nations, in general, this broad concept of punitive severity is usually described to be a shared experience in part by Western advanced nations, England, Canada, New Zealand, United States, Australia. And to some extent, it's argued now that it is matriculating into other nations, parts of Europe are sort of benchmarking some of the practices in some of their areas of the criminal justice system, in large part because they don't have the same exact criminal justice system as we do, so you only see partial adoption of parts of the practices. So longer sentences, as well as explicit legislations that guarantee or quantify sentences upward. There's harsher types of sentences used in these environments, these Western nations. For example, the United States maintenance of corporal punishment and capital punishment is relatively unheard of in advanced nations. Most of Europe doesn't practice death penalty cases. Our adherence to that, the practice sort of goes against the variety of international ethical standards, et cetera. And lastly, sort of like the most objectifiable, the most sort of quantifiable and tangible manifestation of punitive severity is the prison population and mass incarceration. Mass incarceration, in addition to having this, again, uniquely American and uniquely modern quality, also, again, has the disproportionate characteristic, the notion that it's burdened significantly greater on black minority populations than on white majority populations, for example. So the social concern and normative call for social change regarding punitive severity is really the starting point for most sociological perspectives. I guess what I'm, this lecture in combination with the next lecture, which we're taking about a week and a half off, be sure to check your schedule. This lecture, what I would argue is one of the biggest concerns with the entire sort of sociological project is that they overemphasize this one puzzle and are, as a consequence of that, they're overlooking or not paying close enough attention to the building and constructing a consistent framework for understanding criminal behavior, what causes criminal behavior, and then how individual, group, and collective action responds to criminal behavior. Instead, they're very, very focused on this sort of like presumed, packaged, like identifiable phenomenon of punitive severity in its recent manifestations in the Western world. The consequence of being too narrow in that focus has been that we've lost sight of having a rationale of punishment and a framework of criminal justice that can help explain or understand human behavior in a longer historical perspective, as well as the variance across different nations. So again, a lot of the perspectives and frameworks that we're going to cover in today's lecture are going to fall short, I would argue, on these two particular margins, explaining crime trends and punishment trends over time, and explaining crime trends and punishment trends around the world. Why is it that the sociological perspective gets so caught up with this sort of modern phenomenon and explaining it at the expense of a more robust framework of crime and punishment? I would argue is in large part because of some of the causal presumptions or predictions made by earlier big names in the sociological profession, in particular Marx, Durkheim, and Foucault, all of whom, and this is it's paralleled on some sides of the classical liberal perspective as well. Mill and Smith were certainly no fans of incarceration or prisons per se. They were some of the first people to be activists against the practice of torture for criminal investigations, and written and published critics of certain corporal punishment practices, as well as critics of incarceration more generally, in rare instances, but but explicit. Now, Marx, Durkheim, and Foucault, they had this whole perspective that's repeated through a theory of sociological theorists who comment on criminal justice and incarceration. In particular, they argue that as society becomes more capitalistic, as markets become more globalized and so on and so forth, they argue that, well, people are going to be less emotionally and morally and socially tied to these entrenched institutions of cultural justice, cultural vengeance, etc. And so they predicted that we would be converging upon some sort of a restitution standard by now. Ironically enough, the longer historical trend has been opposite of that. Like the earlier periods of history had restitutional trends, and it's our more modern tendencies in which our criminal justice systems have been monopolized by state control and government management, production, etc., that has displaced restitutional standards in favor of more what I would argue could be characterized as arbitrary sentencing practices, in much the same way as we would say that a state plan distribution of capital would be arbitrary relative to how prices would distribute goods and services. I think that we can comparably say that the way in which governments calculate criminal sentences is arbitrary relative to what would otherwise be a more representative epistemic standard of social preferences. And I mean, that's like my whole shtick in a nutshell, is that what we really are missing in the criminal justice system is an epistemic mechanism. And what I mean by epistemic mechanism is in the Hayekian sense, Hayek argues that prices convey knowledge, that what we would really love to do is have some sort of magical insight into the hearts and the minds of like all the people in the world, and then be able to aggregate those preferences into some social production and distribution of goods and services. Obviously, we can't do anything like that. What does the best assessment or approximation of that in the capital structure is the pricing mechanism, right? So we're continuously engaged with cost constraints and asked to make marginal and subtle choices, and then we articulate those choices in financial, quantified, and calculable prices, and those prices, when they interact with one another, send signals to other people who can then act and interact with it. And so it's a very emergent and evolutionary process of distributing goods and services. We don't have anything comparable to that in the criminal justice system today. Different parts in history and different social contexts and locations have had things that work similarly. But today, it's a political process whereby people are elected or appointed or and then expected to sort of manage and design these institutions from on high. So given that Marx, Durkheim, and Foucault thought that criminal justice would be tending towards a more calculative and financial and monetary system of punishment instead of physical, vengeful, cultural, religious, etc. practices, the reality of the last several decades has really sort of shocked a variety of sociological theorists. And it's not this sort of perspective of the dissipation of prisons in particular doesn't stop at Foucault in the 70s per se, but goes up until the early 1980s. Michael Tonry and Norval Morris are two of the sort of leading commentators and historians on incarceration and modern punishment practices. And both of them in the early 1980s and late 1970s were talking about how close and viable advanced society, first world, developed nations were to really evolving beyond, sort of progressing beyond the practice of incarceration, finding more humane, more socially just practices of anything from parole and probationary sentences to social shunning. They were sort of predicting these trends. Now, again, so the standard in which we're going to be trying to evaluate all of the subsequent theories that we're going to survey is how well they explain the time trends of crime and punishment. So can they account for the recent development of mass incarceration and punitive severity, and the recent developments dissipation of crime trends, but also broader histories, cycles of crime and punishment over time, and then lastly, how they relate to crime around the world. So our first perspective is what is called democracy at work. Now, the democracy at work thesis is the closest sociological perspective that you're going to get to the rational choice economic theory of crime. So this slide, I have a photograph here of Gary Becker on the left, who's accredited with sort of inventing the field of economics of crime and punishment with his seminal article, 1968, Economics of Crime and Punishment. Becker was viewed as a sort of economic imperialist. In other words, there were a variety of social science disciplines asking a variety of very interesting questions, and Becker, and on this margin I think he's kind of right, thought that economists have a better analytical toolkit of making sense of those empirical puzzles, making sense of those social phenomena, than do these other social science perspectives, in large part because of the power and applicability of the rational choice framework. So, in addition to Gary Becker on the left, we have Donald Whitman on the right, who's sort of a political science type of scholar. He's Brian Kaplan's sort of arch nemesis. His whole shtick is efficient democracy. So his argument is that democracy produces what it is that people want, and that people are pretty good at operating within the democratic system, that the voting process harnesses the wisdom of crowds in a well-functioning way. And so this diagram in the middle of this slide, where we see how society states and preferences, right, what it is that we believe is true about justice and the appropriate quantities of punishment, well, they get reflected by means of the democratic system, so if into our criminal justice policies. Those criminal justice policies and institutions then produce criminal justice outcomes, like an actual rate of crime and an actual rate of incarceration and an actual like criminal sentencing pattern across those particular crimes. And it's those outcomes that then update our preferences. So we walk outside and we look around the world and we see, okay, well, certain amount of crime is taking place. If we think that that's too much crime, then we go to the voting booth and we vote in officials who will take political action in order to lower that crime rate. And so this, again, the sociological theorists who are associated with this, they don't necessarily contextualize this theory, democracy at work, with Becker and Whitman per se, but the Becker in light of Whitman, I think, is a good way to communicate this perspective to an audience more familiar with economics. Because basically what they're arguing is that from the 1960s through the 1980s, crime was rising and rising and rising. As a response to that, those rising trends of crime, people went to the voting booth and supported political candidates who said that they would get tough on crime. So this is a very like rational, reactionary theory of where we got our heightened degree of punishment. Criticisms or challenges to this perspective would be, first, again, the timely and international nature of the empirical facts and realities of crime and punishment. That criticism is going to run sort of throughout all four. The criticisms that the sociological profession comes up with on each of these theories are mostly tied to additional empirical findings that the previous that each previous perspective sort of fails to account for, and then they get sort of like folded into the next one. So the five sociological perspectives that we're going to cover, it's a very linear research project. These are all contemporary theories of crime and punishment. Marx, Durkheim, Foucault, those guys had much more abstract perspectives that were much more popular in earlier periods. But this is sort of like the current last few decades of sociological work on crime and punishment. And we'll tie more into the abstract sociologies in one of these theories in particular. But so the sociological criticisms of the democracy at work hypothesis are similar to the sociological criticisms of the rational theory of crime more generally, which is that while the framework appears interesting and carries certain levels of empirical testability and verifiability, so Becker's work was followed up by scholars like Isaac Ehrlich and most recently Stephen Levitt and John Lott, that yes, criminals do rationally respond to crime. Criminals do rationally respond to punishment. If you increase the severity of punishment and hold constant the probability of being detected, you will increase deterrence. Vice versa, if you hold constant the severity of punishment and you increase the probability that you'll be captured, you will also increase deterrence. Empirically, like if you go out and you try to measure that, you get reasonable findings. You do see significant effects. Sociological criticism, well, that's interesting, but there's more to be explained than merely the patternistic trends of crime and punishment. In particular, there are the more social trends of racial bias in the criminal justice system. So the Becker model doesn't well differentiate or account for potential racial bias. Again, it's a model that's very, very overly narrowly focused on our recent predicament. It can't necessarily explain previous crime declines that we looked at last week from the Tabarrok slide, where crime rates have a downward cyclical trend stemming back to the 1700s. We didn't have massive punitive severity shocks or gluts during those times. Another sort of obvious criticism would be, well, you know, this direct and mirroring parallel link between social preferences and the democratic process would require criminal issues being like on the tips of tongues and voting fingers every election cycle. But I mean, anyone who watched the presidential debate last night, for example, knows that, I mean, crime and domestic law and order issues aren't really that popular. They were during periods of high crime per se, but not necessarily today, let alone the majority of political issues. They're more popular on the local level. They're less popular at the national level. People tend to vote more significantly about international military issues, border control issues, economic policies, and sort of like social issues more generally than they would be explicitly concerned about crime. And I think that part of that reflects how an insight from development economics, which is that inter-individual conflict is pretty easy to adapt to with a variety of responses. You know, if an ordinary citizen, so to speak, a criminal thug comes in and steals your stuff, you can take significant action to keep him from being successful in doing that again. If the government comes in and takes your stuff, not so much. So that sort of insight is represented in the way in which we have a degree of rational ignorance about policy issues. Lastly, the major criticism of the Democracy at Work thesis, which leads into the next perspective, mainly what's called penal populism, is the Democracy at Work thesis does not live up to or explain well a body of research which has come about in recent years on public opinion regarding crime and punishment. Again, the Democracy at Work thesis argues that the reason why we have harsh criminal justice penalties is because people want them. Because, like, ordinary voters are, if you went around and you asked them, you were like, okay, so what should happen to someone who steals a car or rapes someone or commits armed robbery or mugs someone on the street? People have a sort of vengeful preference. They report very sort of extreme preferences for punitive sanctions. And so in looking at those sort of public opinion surveys, in addition to looking at the time series or the longitudinal aspects of some of those findings, puts into doubt the direct ability of the democratic process to reflect the tastes and preferences of people with regard to crime and punishment. So what we're looking at in this slide is how fearful, in general, people are about crime and punishment. And so what this has been interpreted to lay criticism on the Democracy at Work thesis is the notion that the crime trends during this same period, 1966 to 2008, like after the 1990s, we have a massive decline in crime. And from the 1960s to the 1980s, we have this massive increase in crime with like a huge spike around like 1980 to 1995. And the extremity of those criminal cycles is not matched with the extremity of these sort of public opinions. So people seem just sort of generally unaffected by significant changes in the crime rate relative to their reported concern about the level of crime. This same general insight has parallel relatively static trends in a variety of ways in which these questions get asked. This data is predominantly taken from what's called the FBI victimization survey. They call up ordinary citizens. They ask them a series of questions relating to whether they've been victimized or what their opinions are about crime. All of that data is also included in the general general social science survey, the work that the data set that Brian Kaplan works mostly with. This trend, I think, is concerning to more like activist libertarian types who would take a more attitude towards the police akin to like Eazy-E. But I definitely don't think it's related necessarily to the real effectiveness of the criminal justice system or necessarily the trends of crime or solving crime. Instead, what it almost seems to be most related to is the proportion of police and police-related fields. I mean, what you're sort of looking at is a measure of police special interests, right? So people who generally approve of and or support police interests based on the growing network of personal relationships tied to police industries, as well as all of these public opinion surveys are very staunchly divided on race and income. So, for example, ironically enough, poor African American populations live in environments more plagued by crime, and white affluent whites live in environments less plagued by crime, and yet affluent whites report relatively higher rates of concern about the rate of crime compared to blacks. Similarly, as far as approval ratings, honesty and ethics of police officers, again, it's relatively static, minor, general increase over time. People have, you see the approval ratings of the various constituent components of the criminal justice system, somewhere between this sort of like 40 and 60 range. You never see systematic periods of like massive approval or massive disapproval, whether it be on police, courts, or prison systems, but you do see more accentuated results when you separate out race. In other words, if we were looking just at African Americans, it would be significantly less approval ratings. And if we were looking just at whites, it would be significantly more approval ratings. Same thing with controlling for wage or income. And so to some extent, the long run trend, again, just as much as it might be tracking in part the growth in the network of personal relationships tied to the criminal justice system, it might also be tracing growth in income. Right. So again, the abilities of people privately to protect themselves from the negative effects of crime, right? You might falsely interpret as being an effective criminal justice system at the social level. If everybody in your neighborhood has an alarm and nobody really gets mugged, you think the cops are doing a great job. But what's doing the really heavy lifting there is everybody in your neighborhood having an alarm. Again, public opinion with regard to spending. This one, I think, is anomalous relative to this one, because this one's saying, yeah, you know, today people like cops a lot better than they used to, but nobody wants to give them any more money. Now, this massive decline, I would say, is, again, in large, probably this most recent decline is in response to both the proliferation of the internet as well as more familiarity with the drug trade. But even still, you don't see like sort of bimodal or extreme preferences about money. In general, people presume that criminal justice institutions are the effective means of responding to crime, and they're a good. They're perceived as an economic good. And so if you just ask people, do you want more of a good? They say, well, yes. Until they're asked to actually contextualize that with regard to cost, you're not going to get significant declines. And so I think that this significant decline is the proportion in which we've had the most sort of interaction with real and objectifiable cost. Which brings us to the most significant criticisms of what's called the penal populism perspective. Again, our not only in this case does this theory sort of fail to account for international and long-term trends, but the only data we have is in Western nations, right? So the majority of the studies that have been done say, oh, well, penal populism is so popular that people are vengeful and that people generally support criminal justice institutions. And so to some extent, like again, democracy is working because they have this general approval, but it's not really explaining the particular fluctuations. But the general approval is supported. But we only have data in the countries where we see it. So we don't have data necessarily on support for criminal justice institutions in all countries, let alone at other points in time. So we don't know if that punitive sentiment, that sort of preference for punitive severity, is a new phenomenon or if that's just the standard operating presumption of everyone, like a consistent behavioral characteristic, or if it's a behavioral characteristic across time, spaces, and cultures. We have some evidence to suggest that it would be, right? Sort of basic frameworks of political economy are motivated by the prisoner's dilemma, where people are in the state of nature sort of most inclined to defect against one another in comparison to raving, to trucking, bartering, and exchanging. But also, there has been some empirical support. There's a really interesting book from the late 1960s called The Measurement of Delinquency. And basically, in that book, they did, as best they could, a systematic comparison of different social environments in different places around the world, like with a much greater variance than anything that's being done in these more recent public opinion polls. And what they tracked was the mimicking or the constant similarity of what we could call the ordinal ranking of criminal severity. In other words, if you were to go hang out with the tribes people of a small African nation, and then you were going to go to like Utah and hang out with a bunch of Mormons, chances are that most people in both environments, regardless of time or culture or place, would have a very, very similar ordinal listing of what the worst crime is and what the most like petty crime is. Right? If you had sort of a deck of cards with different criminal behaviors and you asked them to arrange them from most harsh to least harsh, you would get very, very similar ordinal rankings across cultures. Similarly, would you get consistency amongst the severity of punishment? So I think that puts a serious challenge when the puzzle that we're trying to explain is why America or why Western nations are so significantly punitive. I mean, we're all sort of these dirty, vengeful bastards when it really gets down to it. And we all sort of have a similar shared understanding of broad notions of justice, yet these practices are very, very particular to certain national contexts. And lastly, again, the penal populism perspective doesn't necessarily respond to or help explain the racial bias as well as what we're going to get into with the next theory, which is the response to costs. So the closing sort of perspective on penal populism, this is a picture of James Buchanan and Richard Wagner. Buchanan and Wagner co-authored this book, Democracy and Deficit, where it's a criticism of the Keynesian framework, and the argument is not so much that Keynes is wrong with regard to his cause and effect understandings of the macroeconomy, but rather that even if Keynes was right, the democratic process really is ill-equipped to dole out the types of policy responses that Keynesianism would require, namely injections during economic recessions, followed by contractionary policy during excessive economic booms. Like, what politician is going to run on a platform of, oh yeah, the economy's doing too good, I'm going to make everybody poorer during my campaign? Nobody's going to elect that guy. Everybody's going to always elect the guy that wants things to get better and better and better and better, and that leads to this inevitable cycle of deficit, debt, and debasement. Well, how this parallels to the penal populism is that, well, Catherine Becker is a criminal sociologist who has argued that it's not so much the populist sentiment that leads criminal justice policy as much as it is political intentionality. In other words, the penal populism thesis would be very akin to Buchanan and Wagner's perspective, that it's politicians are sort of pandering to these political preferences, and you get this sort of continual systematic bias towards debt on the one hand in the economic terms, but you also get a systematic bias towards severity in terms of the populism thesis. So the response to the penal populism perspective is what's called misinformed democracy. Now, Catherine Beckett's argument is that politicians actually instigate the social preferences, that through the media and through political campaigns, it's sort of like a fear-mongering model that she, what she's tried to do is demonstrate empirically that, that those things precede the types of new punishment policies that we've been so concerned about in the last several decades. So we add availability bias, so to speak, right? So this is, in economic terms, the closest thing that you would get is sort of like a behavioral model, whereby, well, people have like a confused understanding of what's representative of the crime in their local areas. And so we're really misinformed. We're misinformed because we get bad information from news, we get bad information from politicians because it suits particular campaign interests. We support criminal justice policies based on that misinformation. And then criminal justice outcomes sort of get sensationalized and encouraged thereafter. The misinformed democracy thesis is basically rests on the notion that just people don't know that much about the facts and realities of the crime and punishment. So in an ideal world, I wouldn't have needed to give last week's lecture. In an ideal world, people would be well informed about what's going on outside their door regarding crime and punishment. But in reality, people are very ignorant about how many crimes take place in their local neighborhood, how much police response there is, how effective and high quality their police officers are in their local area, how the court process even works, what comes next and where, whether or not their state uses sentencing grids or sentencing guidelines or how much judicial discretion is available or jury nullification. People are very ignorant about the sort of ins and outs of the criminal justice system, especially with regard to what sentence or magnitude of criminal sentence corresponds with what crime. Criticisms regarding the misinformed democracy thesis is, we've got our same sort of standard criticism of, well, everybody's misinformed in every country, so we're not really explaining the variance. And everybody's been misinformed since the get-go, so we're not really explaining the timely nature. In particular, I think the timing issue is a big concern on misinformed democracy. And why that is because as an economist, like we know something about rational expectations. Rational expectations is a very basic concept that argues that when costs and benefits are well individuated, right, when in the market, right, in the stock market, for example, prices reflect the best known information of any individual. So betting markets are a great example of this. When if you know something about how fast a certain horse is, and you go to the betting booth and you drop a ton of money on it, it affects the odds, and everybody sees that, and then that information is relatively shared. Similar happens in stock market prices. In other words, when money's on the line, you make the best bet that you can, and the wisdom of crowds, so to speak, works well in the market because when you're wrong, you pay a significant cost. So, in particular, the misinformed democracy hypothesis really has a difficult time in light of the fact that the financial costs of the criminal justice system have been exponentially rising, in addition to the supposed sort of alertness of the social and cultural costs. So we've got two realms of costs that are both going up. We've also got information which is incredibly cheaper and easier to access. Like, so the bulk of this growth in the criminal justice system has occurred during the age of the internet, and yet people are still sort of systematically misinformed. So what we would really need is an explanation to understand why it is that these forms of misinformation persist rather than just exist. And persist internationally. Lastly, another form of criticism that can be leveled against all these previous perspectives is the ineffective nature of their policy suggestions. So with such emphasis on public opinion, a lot of these scholars emphasize when they get to the parts of their books where they're like, okay, so what do we do about this? Basically, they argue that there should be checks and regulations on the media. There should be a more explicit separation between the political process and the criminal justice system. In other words, a rule by experts or progressive approach where we need more of the criminal justice scientists and social scientists involved in the actual criminal justice system. Now, we can have an argument about whether or not those are good or bad policy suggestions, but the reality of the matter is that, well, as far as the accuracy of the media, the best check that we have experienced in recent years is the proliferation of the internet and the accessibility of good information, which hasn't necessarily swayed or curtailed punitive severity in the United States. But also, our public policies in the last three decades have been extremely progressive as far as criminal justice is concerned. So like, we are trying to get more and more experts involved in criminal sentencing and the design process of our institutions. And yet again, punitive severity, mass incarceration seem to march on and on and on. The last theory is very distinctive from the previous theories. And it's in large part because of the previous theory's inability to sort of be satisfying according to like all of these different margins. However, it sort of like goes the opposite way in so far as the other theories offer all these policy suggestions that don't or haven't really worked, which challenges the sort of framework that they're providing. Late modern anxieties doesn't really offer much of any policy suggestion. And in fact, rests upon what could arguably be described as a sort of Marxist deterministic public policy framework. This diagram on the left, these three circles, this is a diagram taken from Mark Granovetter has a paper on what's called embeddedness in social theory. So Marxist embedded theory is a notion that social phenomena are embedded within these more meta-level institutions. So economic conditions and political institutions influence and determine, it's a flow from the outer circle to the inner circle, and like your wealth and political class, so to speak, will influence the way in which you act and behave, is sort of a crude way of describing this. So some of the language, the major theorist who writes on this issue is David Garland at New York University. He uses the word deterministic, not determined, but deterministic. It's basically like the Diet Coke of determined. Because he doesn't want to hang his hat completely on this sort of like notion of like millennialist Marxism, but he is very much emphasizing the sort of top-down effect of, again, what he calls meta-level social institutions. So what exactly are these meta-level social institutions? Well, it's basically, he's arguing that neoliberalism, mainly the ideology of appreciating markets, in conjunction with the reality of an interconnected globalized society through global markets, are the unique qualities of what we would call post-modernity. And we live in post-modernity. We're no longer industrialized, we're no longer modern, we are post-modern. And as society sort of creatively destructs various forms of social institution in this progression of post-modernity, crime occurs sort of in these fissuring frictions between outdated social institutions and new. And give way to things like expressive vengeance. So in this understanding, the notion that we have these punitive sentiments held by individuals in our society and expressed in public opinion data is sort of interpreted as being like you're mad about the state of society, but you can't really do anything about it. And so the one avenue that we have, you use as often as you can. In other words, it's not so much that harsher penalties fix crime, but it kind of makes you feel better because you don't know how to fix crime, and the one sort of button you have, you push a lot. The second thing it creates it has been discussed most specifically by Glenn Lowry at Brown. Not explicit racism per se, but what I would call racialist apathy. In other words, Lowry believes that, so for example, if we were to imagine that instead of incarcerating significant majorities of African American men in the United States today, we were to have disproportionate incarceration of white men, or say Jews, Asians, like some other less persecuted minority in common culture, he believes that there would be a more significant social response and outcry. And so it's not so much that the system reflects explicit racism, but rather our social inability or unwillingness to fix the system is the action which is sort of racist. And lastly, what has been described by sociologist Local Quaint, UCLA, is segregation of problem populations. Okay, so his argument is that various different points in history we respond to crime and the populations of people who commit them in different ways. And it's not so much that this is a fixed or objective concept, but rather it means different things in different times. So if you really want to understand what the prison used to look like, say 200 years ago, you'd have to look more closely at like halfway houses. You'd have to look more closely at things like insane asylums. Now, lots of those populations who would have been in those forms of institutions 100 or 50 or 200 years ago are now in incarcerated institutions. And so it's about the replacement and convergence of the criminal justice model as opposed to these more socially rehabilitative models that explains a lot of our current excessive incarceration ability. Now, I think that this perspective is the most at odds with just basic economics. In other words, there's very little role of methodological individualism played in these theories, which is to say that they have a very difficult time explaining any empirical observation of rational behavior on the part of criminals. There are minor but significant empirical patterns regarding criminal severity and rational responsiveness to crime, as well as a variety of like more qualitative and ethnographic observations about rational criminal behavior. I think, again, this ignores the longer historical reality that our criminal justice processes were more privately arranged in previous centuries, right? Like, again, they're very narrowly focused on the American experience in the 20th century. But if you look at the history of law more generally, we've had private functioning institutions for a very long time, and it's been a history and a narrative of state monopolization, which has led to a lot of these things, rather than this sort of like new identified feature of neoliberalism. And lastly, it really doesn't explain the variance within similar institutional categories. In other words, Western industrialized, capitalized countries, right, neoliberal societies, so to speak, United States, England, Canada, New Zealand, all share punitive severity trends relative to other nations, but the U.S. is a freakish outlier even in that group, and this doesn't make any sort of nuanced distinction between those two things. It's also just sort of kind of depressing. There's next to no public policy resolution, and it's just sort of like, okay, this is what's happening, and it's what's going to happen, and that's about all we can hope for. The last theory, I think, is the most compatible with economic perspectives, which is just a comparative institutional approach. So it's not so much as a theory as it has been a method of inquiry. In other words, in recent decades, we've gotten this massive accumulation of data and massive accumulation of case studies on various different countries, and so finally, some criminologists are starting to connect some dots. And what they've noticed, in much the same way as new institutional economics, or the Fraser Index, or the Heritage Index has observed, is that criminal justice outcomes, crime rates, and punishment trends tend to vary in stride with institutional differences. Similar nations have similar criminal justice systems, along with similar GDPs, along with similar institutional legal systems, so on and so forth. The implied model of the comparative institutional perspective is that institutional structures invoke or have social processes act within them, and that those social processes contribute to some form of empirical rates of crime and punishment outcomes. The question is, how do we characterize and understand those social processes? What is the process of institutional change that could ideally make hyper-punitive environments more reasonable or insufficiently deterrent criminal justice systems more effective. The last thing that I would say comes out of the institutional comparative approach is less a challenge of that approach and more a challenge that, well, everyone in this class, and myself, and everyone who favors markets and liberty should take seriously, which is this conspicuous correlation between economic freedom as measured by the Fraser Index or Heritage Index, this one's taken from Cato's, and prison populations. In other words, what is being implied by many of these theorists, in particular, the sort of last theorist associated with late modern anxieties, I suppose, would be the best category to fit him in, is this guy, Bernard Harcourt, who's the head of the political science department at Chicago and was a contemporary or a colleague with Becker and Levitt. He has a new book called The Illusion of Free Markets, where he's basically arguing that our criminal justice system is sort of the dirty secret of capitalism. I don't think that there's good or sufficient evidence or causal explanation to support this theory. And so the question is, what's the causal explanation to respond to it? Because the empirical reality is there. What we need to do is understand how it is that our institutions are structured. I think the biggest response to this should be that institutions in a nation, for a nation, are not singular, right? All neoliberal environments are not all uniformly neoliberal. In other words, there are sort of arenas for monetary policy, arenas for economic policy, arenas for social and civil policy, arenas for domestic, regulatory, urban planning, so on and so forth, right? The policy arena is just as heterogeneous as the capital structure. And so some of those environments might be very, very deregulated and liberal and open. Market economies, international trade, et cetera. Other arenas, right, like our criminal justice system, might be very illiberal and very monopolized by government and very centralized. And so it's a matter of recognizing what are the components of institutional environments and which of those components most directly contribute to incarceration rates relative to general institutional categories. That is all I would like to cover for this lecture. Next lecture, we're going to be surveying economic theories of crime and punishment, which arguably many in their general operating presumptions stand in direct conflict to the ones that we've discussed thus far. So if you have a question that you would like to pose with our remaining 20 or 30 minutes or so, please type in the chat box question, and I'll hand you the microphone, and you can ask it, and everyone can hear you. Or if your question is simple and to the point, you can feel free to type it. No one has questions. Also, you can use participate menu, ask for microphone. I believe that. Come on, no one has questions? Question, Manjula. Okay, so make panelists. Pass mic. Manjula? My mic is not working. I'll have to type. Go ahead, Manjula, type. Cameron has a question. Make panelists. Pass mic. Cameron, go ahead. Oh, he typed it. There seems to be a correlation between a country's physical area and incarcerated population. You mean how big of an expanse it is? I guess looking at the map slide, I mean, yeah, Russia, China, and the U.S. are all, as well as Australia. I don't think that correlation is necessarily caused by geography per se, but it might be indicative of the nature of institutions that are associated with larger geographic environments. So the more dispersed your population and the larger, the more sort of significant your social controls might need to be in order to, or the more severe your punishment practices might need to be in order to have effective social controls. But that, I mean, that's a very good observation. The other thing with that is also the heterogeneity of the population is probably also affected because our larger nations also tend to be more populated. So like nations that sociologists tend to really like as far as their criminal justice systems are the European corporativist environment. So Germany is a big one that people point to and say, oh, well, they're relatively modest and they have decent crime rates and so on and so forth. Again, Sweden's social services are sort of fawned over by everyone. But again, much higher degrees of cultural homogeneity can in part explain their lower crime rates as well as the ease with which their institutional responses function. Manjula, well, pursuing economic freedom is going contrary to the Constitution, so how do we go above resolving this issue? You're going to need to explain a little bit more. How is pursuing economic freedom going contrary to the Constitution? So sociologists offer theories. Do psychologists offer psychological theories for the Western penal patterns? I suppose psychological perspectives are in part folded into a lot of these sociological perspectives. So like the late modern anxieties theory, for example, is one which is driven by anxiety. So it's sort of like the psychological component of the public opinion data research is all about how it is that people have these sort of vengeful preferences. I'm not a psychologist, and I don't necessarily read up on terribly much on the psych literature. But there, I mean, the other reason for that is like there's a lot of attention paid to particular types of criminal psychology, serial killing, things like that, and particularly sort of like brutal and violent crimes, as well as child molestation and rape issues in the psych literature. And that's predominantly what those literatures focus on. And when you get to international comparisons, a lot of those figures, those trends don't necessarily drive the magnitude of the criminal justice systems. So, for example, in the Western democracies, it's mostly like drug and property and violent crimes, oftentimes gang-related, oftentimes organized crime-related. Those are the major influences on actual criminal justice policy. So when you're making comparisons across nations, rarely is it that one nation is significantly different from another because they happen to have a lot of serial killers or something like that. I mean, there's only like a few hundred ever been sort of documented in the course of human history. On the economic freedom versus incarcerated population chart, there was a low right point. Was that Hong Kong? What theory do they apply that allow both low prison populations and high economic freedom? Let's see. My guess is actually that that's more Japan than it is Hong Kong. Japan, they have a lot of restitution practices as well as more probation and parole. So, and a large part of that is driven by the cost constraints of space. In highly populated, dense environments, you really just don't have the room to house inmates relative to other countries. Lowry's work at this point, incarceration and later taking away the right to vote from the incarcerated, this would prove to be against the Constitution. So how can we really approach this issue? Okay, Manjula, I think, well, you're right. Many states have sort of started to put restrictions on the right to vote from the incarcerated, which creates the potential for a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have like a persecuted minority of the incarcerated, then they're going to stay that way because they have no way to influence the democratic process. Other than simply not doing that practice, I'm not really entirely sure. I mean, what if you're arguing that the removing suffrage from inmates is unconstitutional, I mean, I think that's the problem with all constitutional arguments, is that typically the first response to saying that something is or is not unconstitutional is always nuh-uh or yaha. everybody's going to reinterpret the Constitution differently. So aside from finding some more binding constraint to actually keep governments from removing suffrage, which I admittedly I don't have a practical solution for that. Does racial homogeneity in a country state correlate with lower crime or incarceration rates? It's not necessarily racial homogeneity, but it is just sort of like cultural and ethnic homogeneity. The European and Scandinavian countries have lower crime rates and lower incarceration rates. So the most difficult part in just explaining incarceration rates proper is that it's a difficult apples and oranges or apples to apples comparison, because you've got different population sizes, different population densities, you've got different cultural communities, different rates of economic progress, so on and so forth, different criminal laws even. Is there some degree in which we can make a logical case that that homogeneous societies have lower crime rates? Of course, because culturally homogeneous communities are going to have easier rates of solving coordination problems than others. And insofar as they have lower crime rates, we would expect them to have lower punishment rates. But punishment rates aren't directly driven by crime rates either. Stephen Davis, are there any countries that currently allow any sort of competition at all with the state regarding crime and punishment? Security, there's certainly significant degrees of competition with the state in pretty much every Western nation. I mean, there are more private police officers in the United States than there are public police officers. Whether or not it's considered direct competition, I don't know. And then there's also private prisons per se, but they're contracted out. The question is, do private citizens, private corporate entities have the ability to engage in the sentencing process? Rarely. Most environments have a monopoly on the state or by the state on the process of deeming what is criminal and then doling and calculating the amount of punishment that goes along with that criminal violation. Some of the more interesting institutional differences between, say, like in parts of England, for example, you don't have a public prosecutor's office, but rather that responsibility is borne by detectives and the arresting officers. So it's arresting officers who sort of make the case against the defendant. There's pros and cons to that environment. The United States, for example, is the only country in sort of the course of human civilization that from its inception we had a public prosecutor's office. In other words, a distinctively defined criminal realm of the legal system. Most countries had to evolve they experienced some form of institutional change from privately functioning criminal justice systems of akin to the Anglo-Saxon system that Benson describes and Friedman looks at in the Iceland scenario. Like the British system started as a system of torts, a system of arbitration and conflict resolution, a system of personal property rights protected by criminal law, but predominantly the criminal law was after you first had sort of civil proprietary law. So things like violent social norms and violent punishments piggybacked or benchmarked financial compensation mechanisms when you had contractual disputes. And it wasn't until you got more formal states, formal government institutions that you started to get a distinctive and formalized criminal justice system, where the state defined categories of behavior that were deemed criminal, and then managed and subsidized the enforcement resources to keep those actions criminal. In today's terms, we identify the distinction between the criminal law and the civil law by means of incarceration. We say that is criminal, which is incarcerable. That wasn't always the case. It used to be that private citizens had the right and the legitimacy to impose physical violence and or physical force and coercion to extract debt, to enforce contracts, to reclaim their property and or monetary or valuable damages from someone who had wronged them after a civil case had supported their case. That privilege was essentially monopolized by governments around the beginning of the 19th century. So the United States experience, the American experience, is the only nation that begins from its onset with a public prosecutor's office, with a clearly distinguishable criminal realm from civil realm from its onset. I think that's very much part and parcel of the story that's not really addressed in any of these perspectives, that we sort of got a head start on the slippery slope towards totalitarian enforcement than any other country, in addition to having our sort of wealth-supportive common law, which accommodated for what Tyler Cowen sort of calls government by horse cart growth, right? So Tyler Cowen's like, well, we didn't used to have as big a government as we used to, but we didn't used to have as big of anything as we used to, right? It was very difficult to get around and collect taxes and then grow bureaucracies when you didn't have automobiles, when you didn't have telecommunications, when you didn't have an advanced division of labor. I mean, the model of the state sort of piggybacking off the market is akin to a parasite. The bigger, the healthier the host, the healthier the parasite. What are the questions? Is it just people's psychological view in America that you have the freedom to do what you want, and if you break it and or misuse this freedom, not provided in such a way, compared to other countries, you will be punished clearly? Is this massive incarceration a price of provided freedom? I mean, I think that's some of the implication, but I don't necessarily think that the magnitudes match up. I think that the degree of freedom that we have relative to, say, England or Canada is not in proportion to the degree of incarceration that we have relative to Canada or England. While proverbially I think that might make sense, I actually think the opposite makes more sense when we understand a more consistent or a robust theory of social order and spontaneous order. Namely that I think it's, and we'll get into this as the course continues throughout the semester. I mean, arguably what I'm trying to do is differentiate what we could call an individualist evolutionary theory of classical liberalism from a rationalistic neoclassical perspective of classical liberalism. If you look at the opening chapter of Individualism and Economic Order by Hayek, he makes this distinction. Like, basically, the comparison that we'll talk about as well is the difference between thinkers like Bentham on the one hand and Alexis de Tocqueville on the other, both of which commented explicitly on the criminal justice system and incarceration. Bentham sort of applying formal calculative models of rational choice, no different in substance, really, than Becker's rediscovered model centuries later, whereas Tocqueville was far more sort of like an organic, spontaneous order theorist. I'll scroll back up to more of the questions. I'm just doing what I see when I see it. Hayek, in his opening essay in Individualism and Economic Order, basically argues that the Benthamite tract is an inevitable tract towards socialism. That it's not so much that the model is wrong, but it is most likely wrongly applied or overapplied. And when overapplied is bound for some for sort of systematic bias, which I think that general narrative applies well to explain a lot of the 20th century's criminal justice experience, especially in the United States. So what do you think about the concept of the state not being able to bring charges? Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty open anarchist. I don't think the state should be able to do anything. I think it's odd that the state is the sort of prosecutor du jour, like the people versus so-and-so. And if you look at the history of the development of criminal law more particularly, the rhetoric and the rationale of crime more generally had to have victims in its earliest manifestations, and so this whole notion of like a harm to society is the rhetoric that gets tacked on in order to address that concern. I don't think it holds theoretical water per se for a variety of reasons, but I think that the most sort of objective and positive implication is that when you have the state levy claiming victimhood against persecutors, then it gives them also this ability to define a new scope of crimes, that basically anything can be deemed criminal because it's whatever against the state's interests. I missed questions up earlier. Didn't check mail now. Thanks, Ethan. Are there countries that currently allow any sort of competition? If not, what is the most recent example of a state allowing any sort of competition in these areas? Answer that. Even if the state doesn't explicitly allow competition to determine crime and punishment, including sentencing, are there countries where this is common? How do they fare? Even if the state doesn't explicitly allow competition in determining crime and punishment, are there countries where this is common? How do they fare? No. No countries allow for independent, I mean, that sort of like conflicts with the definition of the state. Most of the statistics that we have are from Western nations, but I'm wondering if there are any statistics at all regarding crime and incarceration from nations that operate with polycentric or customary law systems, for example, Somalia. Have there been any studies done in these territories, or is it too difficult to collect data from them? Okay, the thing about Somalia is that it's very, 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 very new, and very, very limited data exists that would be of any significant quality. So, I mean, like, Ben Powell and Pete Leeson's work on this, they admit in the course of their papers that their available data is very limited, but they're extrapolating from the best data that's available. And the majority of the data that's being collected in Somalia is about, it's very broad aggregate data, like stocks of food and number of people. They're not tracing subtle social processes. There's nothing akin to a criminal justice system going on there. The closest thing that you have to empirical reports of functioning criminal justice systems in polycentric legal environments would be the conflict resolution disputes that take place in Wikipedia and online communities, the report of the Icelandic sagas from David Friedman's article, my own sort of reporting on the ancient Greece case, as well as the descriptions of dispute resolution in Leeson's pirate histories and Bruce Benson's Anglo-Saxon Virgo system. Now, again, in those environments, it comports to the sort of cardinal and ordinal magnitude parallels across different environments, right? Like, it's not like pirates really hated tap dancing and made it criminal in like some weird way that that other societies would never do. To the extent that these different, like radically different social environments have different criminal codes and punishment systems is representative of the functional needs and requirements of their social environment. So pirates are really against shooting while on a pirate ship. Well, that makes sense when you're on a pirate ship because shooting things puts holes in the boat and everybody sinks and drowns. Whereas in general, like murder is considered significantly more severe than theft, higher amounts of theft more than others. Theft of items which are crucial to survival are often punished more severely, so on and so forth. So the general pattern of rational, functional criminal justice institutions without formal governance seems to fit according to the limited available sampling of polycentric legal systems that we have. Alex White, I know you. With the late modern anxieties theory, do you think the issue of racial apathy could represent a switch from direct racism to actual tolerance as Generation X and Y replace the baby boomers? Well, I think the problem with hoping for significant change in Gen X and Gen Y is the fact that Lowry's not really accusing baby boomers necessarily of being explicitly racist. He's blaming them for being lazy. So it's not so much that Gen X and Gen Y are more tolerant and that will help, but rather they would have to be more activist in order for that to, if the late modern anxieties is right, that it's an apathy that's causing this problem. To the extent that it does seem that criminal justice results are getting a lot more attention in recent times. What I'm working on most recently is a lecture / presentation for the Porcupine Freedom Festival that I'm going to next week. Hope to see some of you guys there. But I'm trying to communicate or draw upon what I consider to be the useful theoretical implications of agorist theory or Samuel Edward Konkin's material. Now, in light of Konkin had a very interesting theory about the role of criminal behavior, or what we could call inappropriate criminal behavior, black market behavior. So libertarians, let's say, or believe in negative rights, right? You have a right to your person and property and so on and so forth. So let's call violent and property crime proper crimes. And then improper crimes would be sort of victimless crimes. Konkin's theory was that when your black market of victimless criminal behavior grows beyond the capacity of your legitimate market, that you're going to have to get some sort of social change. And that's essentially what brought down the Soviet Union. I think that the sort of cause and effect relationships he's describing are maybe a little tenuous, and there's not really a good way to empirically verify that that social process. But what I think he's alluding to is actually a pretty nuanced theory of public choice and collective action in sort of a Mansur Olson, James Buchanan competing interests group perspective. In other words, it's not so much the black market relative to the legitimate market, but there is something to be said about if there's a body of stuff the state does, right? So government does, let's say, 100 different things. Let's say 10% of what it does is disliked by some population of the people who it rules over. So lots of people have lots of different complaints about the various things that the state does. But at any given point in time, collecting the biggest group of people who are sort of frustrated with the biggest scope of state activities at any given point in time is always sort of like marginal. For some reason, I think that overstepping violent enforcement, right, the abuse of police powers, could be one sort of thing that has a universal applicability of people who are just sort of like, this is inappropriate for the state. And it's at that point when we have to start recognizing that you don't get, say, the remaining other actions that people might even be okay with the state doing, building playgrounds, schools, et cetera, without also carrying with the scope of activities that people are much more happy about. And so I think it wasn't so much the growth of the black market as much as it was the growth of the militarized police state in both the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, which also, I mean, they're two sides of the same coin in that sense that led to their sort of inevitable collapse. If anything, the black market was sort of buttressing this system and promoting its durability for longer than it otherwise could have taken on. If I'm not mistaken, a red relevant form of literary state that the victim should bring the culprit to crime for any criminal charge to take place. Now, if someone is poor enough and not able to pay for all these charges, incarceration rates may fall just because poor people will not be able to pay for lawyers and judicial practice take place. I advocate for free markets, but how would it even solve this problem? If someone is poor enough and not able to pay for all these things, incarceration rates may fall just because poor people will not be able to pay for lawyers and judicial. I'm not sure you're characterizing Rothbard's position exactly correct. So Rothbard advocates a restitution-based system of sort of forced wealth extraction. I think in libertarian terms it makes sense, though I doubt its effective practicality. If your question is whether or not poor people or rich people would be less deterred against crime in a market-driven criminal justice system, I think that there are obvious ways to react to that with anything from sort of charity markets to collective coordination. In other words, if your network is large enough, regardless of your financial wealth, you can still influence deterrence. And that's a line of research that Ed Stringham is sort of responding to Tyler Cowen's criticisms of anarchism on. Probably from the legal fees. So Scott is similarly sort of responding to what I'm saying. I think that basically puts us about out of time. Freedom Rings and the incarceration, it seems to be fairly weak. Just eyeballing it, there seems to be about as many points above and below that best fit line. Well, it is statistically significant. And it's certainly anecdotally significant. And to the extent that we want to claim American exceptionalism with regard to wealth creation and economic power, we also have this very significant real problem. It's significant insofar as, like, legitimate theorists think it's significant. And so simply saying, well, that's not significant is a pretty inept response, so to speak. But again, we are out of time. Thank you, everyone, for participating. I hope you enjoyed the lecture, and I will see you not next week. Again, I'll be at the Porcupine Freedom Festival. Hope you guys are making it out to that. But the week after that, we're not going to do it on Tuesday. We're going to do it on either Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. If there are dates that work particularly well for you or not well for you, I think you should email Danny Sanchez. We're going to go back and forth in the next few days about when we're going to reschedule that third lecture class. But it's going to be either on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday of the week after next, because I have to travel on the Tuesday. But again, I hope everyone had a good time this evening, and hope to hear from you guys soon. The quiz for the second week will be posted tomorrow. See you guys soon.